accession number 19896, reel 2.
General Woodford, reel 2.
To go on with your, to answer your last question, we certainly didn't take part or receive any major attack, but I remember a fairly major one on our neighbours, who were US Marines, who were the next door position while we were there, when we were on a place called 355. And there were occasional sort of fairly sizable actions used to take place in No Man's Land, but I can't say I took part in one myself.
What opinion did you form of the enemy?
Well, to the extent that one saw that much of them or had much contact with them, I think they were really pretty good. They certainly knew how to move, and they certainly knew how to conceal themselves. Their camouflage is absolutely brilliant, as we discovered on when the truce was declared, because we were in the line when that actually happened. And we'd all speculated about where the positions were. It was the sort of thing you did. And it was really quite remarkable, looking across, at that time, even on the Samichan, if you looked across the valley at the positions of the other side, and what appeared to be absolutely destitute, denuded hills, suddenly you realised what the large number of positions there were on them, because they then took off all their camouflage and emerged, waving little flags. And I can remember on that particular morning, we were too far away, and anyway, the other side of the river, so they couldn't get too close to us. But they tried going up the hook, which at that time was being in the charge of, I think it was the 3rd Royal Australian Regiment, certainly our affiliated Australians. And they all started walking up the hill rather gingerly, carrying their little flags and presumably shouting messages of friendship. The Australians weren't at all impressed by this. The story was that the Australians fixed bayonets and said, "That's enough, you come any further, and truce or no truce, we'll put paid to you." So they thought better of it. But what they were very good at, certainly, was camouflage. They were brilliant at that. And they were pretty good, I think. They were certainly very good, very tough.
Did you see any of their prisoners?
Of their prisoners?
Any of them prisoner?
No, I can't say I did, no. I certainly never took any.
Any contact at all with Korean civilians?
Oh, yes. Civilians. Well, apart from the porters, these extraordinarily tough little men who used to bring kit up the hills to us, we had these porters, great sort of teams of them, and they were quite extraordinary. They used to carry on sort of wooden A-frames, carry weights you wouldn't believe up these really quite steep hills. Apart from that, no, I can't say I did. I mean, I was never long enough in Seoul, except sort of coming and going, to meet any civilians. What we did have during my time was, for a period, we had Republic of Korea soldiers attached to us. I had 4, I think it was, or maybe 5, in my platoon, and we all had the same experience. So you would have a small section or half section of Korean soldiers attached to you, and that was quite interesting.
In what way?
Well, what was interesting about them was that, of course, none of us spoke Korean, and none of them spoke English, so communication wasn't all that easy. Some of them had 1 or 2 words, but mostly we got along all right. What they were extremely good at was looking after their kit, and you never had, for example, to inspect their weapons. Well, you did, but you knew after the first couple of times that you needn't spend too long on it, because they were always immaculate. When it came to patrolling, and on patrol, the story was a little bit different, to be honest. I certainly had 1 or 2 rather unfortunate experiences with them, where either they just didn't show up. In other words, you'd be moving in bounds, and you'd suddenly find you'd gone on bound number 3, and I've forgotten their names now, but they were all, we used to have nicknames for them. But let's say you had a nickname for Kim, call him Kim or something like that, you would suddenly find that Kim was missing. Well, you hadn't got time to go looking for him, so you would continue your patrol, and when you came in again, you'd probably find him still sitting just outside the wire where he'd stayed all along, because he wasn't about to go out and go put his neck on the block, which is very understandable. The other thing they quite often used to do, and I remember at least 2 of them, when we was lying out in ambush patrols, and this quietly went to sleep, and we jolly nearly went back and leaving them behind. I don't know quite how they managed that. But they were... what you might call domestically, they were extraordinarily neat and tidy and looked after themselves very well. The other thing that impressed me tremendously was that every single one of them wrote long letters home every single day. And all the, any mail or letters used to be brought to my hutchie, the platoon commander's hutchie, where it was collected, usually by my orderly, and given to either the colour sergeant or whoever who came up in the evenings when we got food brought up. And the Korean soldiers, I would think without exception, and I doubt they missed many days, but mostly they would write a long letter home each day.
Did you say bound number three?
Well, if you were moving in bands on a patrol, something like that, you'd move from one point to another. Either you'd have a plan to do it, or you'd, depending on the circumstances and how dark it was and one thing or another. And as I say, you'd move, stop for a bit and observe, and then move on a bit. So having done that a couple of times, you'd suddenly find that somebody was missing.
So the different stages were called bounds?
Sometimes, yes.
What were your living conditions like?
Well, living in a trench, in a hole in the ground, sandbags. They were, I suppose you would say, fairly primitive. I mean, we made ourselves as comfortable as we could, which is not very comfortable, one can't say that, but I mean, with any luck, if you were lucky, you were dry, and you could have a reasonably dry place to sleep. The food was basic, but I suppose it was all right, which came up each night, usually in containers, carried by these great porters. Sometimes we had rations which we looked after for ourselves, and of course we had quite a lot of brew kits. There were certain bits of kit which were like gold dust. For example, tilly lamps, if you know what a tilly lamp is. And because the mantles of those are a little bit delicate, they tended to go a bit quickly. So if you had a very good orderly like mine, he used to have a little private supply. How he got them, I wouldn't know, but I wouldn't like to ask. But he used to have a little private supply of spare mantles for our tilly lamp, things like that. But tilly lamps were certainly very important bits of kit. And I can remember vividly, again, my orderly, who was a delightful man called Feinstein. He was an East End Jew. And very amusing. And he was a great collector of kit. He was very good at it. And how he did it, I'm not quite sure, but he managed somehow to persuade the colour sergeant to give us a brand new tilly lamp, a real beauty. And, of course, he was delighted with this, and he'd sort of clean it all up and had it sitting on a sandbag just at the entrance to the platoon headquarters, hutchie. And he'd just done all this and got it all cleaned up, and suddenly we had a mortar stonk, which was fairly regular. I mean, we used to get stonk pretty often, and they were very accurate, those 60mm mortars. And so we all took cover, as one should, bolted into our holes. And when the dust had settled and the thing was clearly over, we came out, and I can remember poor old Feinstein almost in tears, because the tilly lamp, which he'd left on the sandbag outside, was absolutely riddled and was no longer any use to anybody. But that's a sort of memory I hadn't thought of for a long time.
So why were tilly lamps so important to you?
Well, because they were very good, they were efficient, they made a very good light, they lasted quite a long time.
And why was, in what way was this Feinstein so humorous?
Well, he just was. He was just a quick-witted, amusing chap. I mean, he used to try everything on, too. He was a typical sort of old soldier. He must have been all 19 or 20, I suppose. But he'd old soldier, you were given half a chance. You had to watch him. But he was very good. He was a very efficient chap, and he did his stuff very well. But, for example, he tried it on me as a new boy. He said, you know, he'd like me to be taken off the patrol roster because he reckoned he'd done his share. Of course, one couldn't possibly agree to it, but I think it's not a bad try. He made a very persuasive speech about how important it was that he got home in one piece because his family depended on him and this sort of thing. No, he was just a card. I'm sorry not to have met him again. I've never seen him again. The last I saw him, sadly, was in the canal zone where we were after Korea, when I had to tell him that his father had died. This was just before he was demobbed, and so he didn't get home in time to see him, which was, of course, which upset him terribly, not surprisingly.
You haven't said anything so far, I think, very much about the other allies, if you saw much of those.
We saw a bit. We saw a bit of the Americans, and we saw a little of the Australians. Particularly our affiliated regiment with the Australian Rifles, Royal Australian Rifles. And a number of our company commanders, of course, I think all our company commanders, when I think of it, had all had Second War experience. Some of them, a lot of experience. And I can remember, for example, going with my company commander once when we were in reserve to visit, I think it was 3rd RER, to visit an old friend of his. They'd been in the war together in Italy, I think. And we went across and had a chat with him. And he was an old, tough old warrior, too. It was quite funny, because at the time that we were having a chat, this was in reserve, about, I suppose, about 10 miles back from the line, in area whatever it was, area 3 or somewhere. We got an unexpected visit from a new Australian brigadier. And there was my company commander's friend, who was, they say, a tough old warrior, who was standing there having just had a jolly good wash, just with a towel around his middle and a rather scarred body, and taken a bit by surprise, and this brand new, very smart looking brigadier appeared with his entourage. And they had quite an amusing conversation, I remember.
What do you remember about the conversation?
Well, the main bit I remember is that they were discussing the new brigadier, who was a rather austere man. I seem to remember, I think his name was Daly, and I'm sure he finished up as the head of the Australian Army. He was apparently a very clever chap. But he was a bit, I think he was known to be a bit of an intellectual in those days, and not thought to have had all that much experience, and certainly wouldn't have had anything like the operational experience of the chap he was talking to, the company commander. But they talked about this and that, and they were looking out towards where the opposition were. Of course, from when you were in reserve, I guess you could still hear artillery, because it wasn't that far away. And looking at the sort of geography, and I can't remember the detail, but he talked about various places where they could come through if they decided to mount some kind of offensive. And he pointed at some particular bit of the horizon and said, well, that looks to me like the sort of place where they might come through. And I'm afraid, even to me, as a sort of humble platoon commander, it didn't look like a very good idea to me. I thought, that's an odd thing to say. Because he clearly didn't, he didn't know the area. But anyway, this none too respectful Australian company commander, I remember very well looking at him with a sort of rather withering look and saying, forgive my Australian attempt at an Australian voice, and saying, well, they wouldn't get many marks at the Staff College for that, would they, Brigadier? I always remember that because we hooted with laughter. Anyway, that's about as much as I can remember of the Australians. I mean, we did see a little bit of them. Oh, the other thing I do remember particularly was on the day of the truce, the morning after, that's to say, because the truce, I think, was declared at midnight. Was it the 27th of July, I think it was? Anyway, the following morning, when we were startled to see all these Chinese positions, which suddenly, you know, took all the camouflage off and you could see where they had been. What I do remember is with the period running up to that, we used to have various standing patrols down on the river on the Samichon. And I can remember the stories about when the Australians were doing the same sort of thing, that instead of doing what we used to do, which is to creep down to your position as quietly as you could, and when you got there, keep as quiet as you possibly could and hope that you could see something or whatever, as a sort of OP, which is what it was. The story was the Australians, instead of doing that, used to go down there making as much noise as they could, and when they got into their particular OP position, would all chatter and rattle beer cans and things in an attempt to encourage somebody to have a go at them, because they were longing to give them a good thumping. That sounds fairly typically Australian to me. We also had, now I come to think of it, we had some Australians attached to us. I mean, I think it was 3 of them in my platoon, and that was an interesting experience too, because they were all really experienced chaps from the Second War, private soldiers, lance corporals, re-enlistments. And 2 of the chaps I had, I remember, had New Guinea experience from the Second War.
Did the political aspect of the war mean anything to you?
One would like to say, yes, it did, and at least basically it did. I think I had a rough idea of what it was about, and the fact it was a United Nations operation. I mean, one was continually reminded of that. I can't pretend now. It's difficult to say, looking back on it. I mean, in theory, I suppose I ought to have been a little bit more aware of it than, say, an 18-year-old Cockney from Whitechapel. I think perhaps I was. But I had a rough idea, yes. Certainly not a particularly sophisticated one, I don't think. One was often a bit surprised to find oneself there at all and think, what are we doing here?
Was there any sense in which you felt you were fighting communism?
No, I wouldn't say that, not directly. Although, of course, they were known to be... I say known to be. I mean, they were regarded as, in inverted commas, Reds. You know, they were the Chinese army with the red star on their caps. But I don't think communism, with a capital C, was something that was much in one's mind. Certainly not in the private soldiers.
Any contact with what you might call psychological warfare on either side?
Oh, apart from what you might call the more primitive manifestations of it. For example, the broadcasts they used to have when you were in the line, you would suddenly hear them in the middle of the night. You would hear these great sort of broadcasts when they put up a tannoy system and would promise you presence if you defected and tell you all the sort of horrible things that were happening to your loved ones back home. And then the various songs and so on, and I can't remember what they called her. Was it Shanghai Lil or something? Anyway, there were various songs that were sung, and they were always promising what were known as presentos if you defected or did something that would suit them. Those were about the only examples one had, and occasionally one used to get the odd leaflet and thing, pick up the odd leaflet and so on, saying much the same sort of thing.
What was your reaction to the armistice?
Relief. Pleasure. You know, thank God it's all over, really. Not that I'd had a particularly hard time, although, I mean, it was very strenuous, a lot of it, but compared with people who'd been there much longer and we'd had much more difficult time. But no, certainly, one was very pleased it was all over. Well, we thought it was all over, of course it wasn't.
How do you feel now about having served in the Royal Fusiliers in the Korean War?
Well, I feel very lucky to have had the opportunity. It was a fascinating experience.
I think after this you spent a time in the Canal Zone?
Yes, yes we did. We were there for about 6 or 7 months. Much to the displeasure, I may say, of the soldiers, who thought they deserved better. They wanted a much more cushy posting, particularly the ones who were due for demob quite soon.
You were still a national serviceman, were you?
Yes, I was.
Was there any trouble whilst you were in the Canal Zone?
Well, yes, in a way there was. We were in a... what in those days was just a bit of... salt marsh, Subka, as it's called, a place called Cabrit, which is the southern end of the Great Bitter Lakes, in a tented camp. And there was still quite a lot of, I suppose you would call it, terrorist activity, but certainly there were a good many people who were fairly hostile to the British Raj, in a sense, and there were, you know, there were all sorts of restrictions. There was a security situation, and the odd shooting used to go on, and we had quite stringent rules. And there were guards, you know, important and very sizable guards, and anything that mattered, for example, ammunition depots and the like. There was a famous platoon commander's guard up at Tel Kebir, the big ammunition depot up there, site of a famous war, which, oddly enough, my grandfather took part in.
Did you say Subka?
Subka, yes. S-A-B-K-H-A was the usual way it was pronounced.
Is that Arabic for salt marsh?
Yes.
Did you have any unpleasant experiences yourself with Egyptians?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, I had a very interesting time because I spent a lot of my time umpiring exercises. We had a huge army there that in those years, if you may recall, or if not recall, you would know. I think that the British troops in Egypt was probably bigger than the Rhine Army later. But anyway, I spent a lot of my time, as I say, umpiring exercises with other units, which was quite fun. And so I saw quite a lot of the Canal Zone, particularly going down to the Suez Hills and places like that. And I can remember once, for example, being picked up in the middle of the desert by the GOC British troops, one General Festing, who later became Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And he gave me a lift, driving his own Land Rover, or I think, was it a Land Rover? It may have been a Champ, I can't remember now. But he used to drive his own, and that was a very exciting experience because he drove like a whirlwind, regardless of what was in the way. But I had an amusing time, really. We did our best to enjoy ourselves in that, you know, we played every sort of game we possibly could and took part in all the sort of inter-regimental competitions and that sort of thing. But actually, it was quite. We worked and trained pretty hard.
Was it a popular or unpopular posting with the soldiers?
It was pretty unpopular, for the reasons I just said. I mean, they felt, having done their stint in Korea, that they ought to have gone somewhere much more cushy. because, I mean, it was pretty bleak, and of course there was the scope for the soldiers was much less even than for the officers, and there wasn't much for us. I mean, about the only thing we could do was go to the officers' club in Fide. And the soldiers could also go to various clubs and things in Fide, but really there wasn't much scope, and there was certainly no female company worth the name.
So, at some stage, you must have decided to stay on as a regular officer.
Yes, it was right then. It must have been right that sort of time, towards the end of career. Yes.
Why?
And I applied then. Well, I don't know. I rather enjoyed the life, and I had possibly the illusion that I was quite good at it. And I thought, well this will do me. I would like to do this. And so I applied for a regular commission, which I got, I think, about a year later.
This is about 54, 55?
Yeah. 54, I think it was. Yes, 54, I'm sure it was. By that time, we were in the Sudan. I had to go back from the Sudan to do a regular commissions board.
A bit later in the 50s, you were in Bahrain.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the job you did there, please?
Well, Bahrain.
Berlin.
Oh, Berlin, sorry. Yes. I was going to say the Sudan was quite interesting. We were the last battalion there before it became independent, but that was quite interesting. Because that was like serving in sort of 19th century India in lots of ways.
In what sense?
Well, simply because, well, for example, we were in Blue Nile Barracks, Khartoum. Or Khartoum, as the soldiers called it. Well, Blue Nile Barracks, it was actually on the Nile. And everything about it was really very like the old Raj. They still had a Qaid. In other words, the commander of the Sudanese army was known as the Qaid. The governor was, as it happened, an old royal fusilier. General Sir Reggie Schoons. Sorry, yes, Cully Schoons he was known as. But the whole setup was out of another age in lots of ways. And we had a detachment up in the Red Sea Hills at a place called Gabate. And there you literally were surrounded, not surrounded by, but trotting out of the desert would come fuzzy-wuzzies, looking pretty much as they must have done in the 19th century, hardly changed, with their camels.
What was their attitude towards you?
I've no idea, to be honest. I think they regarded us, of course, as a source of help for whatever it might be, whether some kind of support of any kind. But I do remember particularly when we were up in Gabate, I was up there with one of the companies of the battalion. We had a national service doctor, a very nice Irishman, and he was summoned by a fuzzy-wuzzy because this fuzzy-wuzzy's son had been bitten by a snake, almost certainly a Russell's viper, though we didn't know that at the time, and the doctor was required. So the doctor got his bag, and here he was in his sort of shirt and shorts and trucker boots, and he was invited to mount this camel, which he'd never done before. Anyway, he did, and off they trotted. What he didn't realize was that to go back to this the fuzzy-wuzzy's village was a several hours trot. Of course, you can imagine the state. By the time he got there, he could hardly move. He was not used to trotting on a camel. Anyway, the story we heard later, which I think it probably improved with the telling, but when he got there, this small boy, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old, was lying, looking very poorly indeed, with an extremely heavily swollen leg. And he said, I thought there was absolutely no hope at all. I couldn't see anything I could do for him. So all I could do was just to give him an injection of some sort. I can't remember what it was now, but I think it was a painkiller. I think he gave him a jab of the serum as well they used to carry, but thinking it was far too late for all that. However, remarkably, whether it was just because fuzzy-wuzzies are inherently very tough, the boy started to improve by the next morning, and in the end made a full recovery, which of course enhanced his reputation hugely. But he then was faced with the several hours trot back, and by the time he got back to us, he was in a very poor state, because he had practically no skin on his backside at all. But I remember that. That was like something out of another age. Anyway, that didn't last all that long, but it was very interesting and amusing while it lasted. And one of my main impressions of that was we got to know a lot of the old Sudanese political service. You remember, who were a famous breed, even more than the Indian civil service. It was known rather unkindly, but fairly accurately, as the rule of the blacks by the blues, because if you remember, you had to have at least one blue, preferably more, and a first from Oxbridge, otherwise you didn't get even looked at. And they were all that sort of quality of chap. And what I was so impressive about them was, even to the untutored eye, I mean, not that we knew that much about it, but you could see that they did their jobs absolutely full blast, right up to the last minute, despite the fact they knew that when they handed over, I say they knew, I mean, I think they did, that from that moment on, it would all be downhill, and what they had spent a long career achieving would very quickly disintegrate, and I'm afraid that's what happened. But they were an impressive lot of people.
Are Fuzzy Wuzzers just Sudanese civilians or some particular branch?
No, they're an actual tribe, and it's a sort of, one really ought to use the right word, and I wish I could remember it. I think I put my finger on it if I knew where to look it up, but they were always known as Fuzzy Wuzzers. But I mean, they were very black indeed. They were, I suppose, Nilo-Hermitic. They weren't Negroid, but they were very black, because in that climate it is extremely hot. I mean, it went up to, 130, 140 up in the Red Sea Hills there. And that's where they lived. And they had this tremendous great head of hair, hence the nickname, and carried spears. I ought to know. I mean, there was more than one tribe, of course, but they were all pretty much the same, clans of the same major tribe, and they were hillmen, not unlike the northern Ethiopians. And as you know, formidable fighting men in their day.
If we could just go on to what I asked you about Berlin, the job you did there.
The job was straightforward. Yes, that was, I was ADC to the British Commandant in Berlin, who was at that time the colonel of my regiment.
What was his name?
His name was Rome, General Claude Rome. His actual name was David, but he was always known as Claude. And I was with him from early 56 until late 58.
What kind of duties were involved with being ADC?
Well, it was rather different from what you might call the ordinary time, particularly in those days, because this was the height of the Cold War. It was just before the Hungarian uprising, which happened later that year. And it was a very politically charged atmosphere in Berlin. It wasn't all that long since the airlift and also the June 53 uprising in the East, which had been quelled. And it was a very interesting time indeed. My job, apart from being the usual sort of military side of being an ADC, was very like being a sort of third secretary in an embassy, really, because one sat in the office work was very much on the diplomatic side rather than the military, although there were quite a bit of military as well. And that's what, of course, made it extraordinarily interesting. But as I say, it was very like being a sort of a junior hand in an embassy somewhere, because one used to read all the dip-tells and attend all the briefings and that kind of thing. Very interesting.
Did you have much contact with the Russians?
Yes, quite a lot, because up until the Hungarian events, there was quite a serious attempt going on to try and thaw the ice a little. And we had a series of meetings, many of them at high level, and I was, with a number of others, a sort of flunky in the background, you know, passing the gin and making the administrative arrangements. But one sat on the outskirts listening to all this, which was actually extraordinarily interesting. And they had to be done with great discretion, too. And I remember when they came to visit, and they came a couple of times, and the meeting was in the general's office, which was a splendid great office in the Olympic Stadium, which was the British military government, as it was called. In fact, his office had been the Reich Minister for Sports office, a splendid great affair. And having the Russians in there, with all the usual sort of people you can imagine. The Russian commandant was usually a distinguished soldier, but not a politician. And the man who really ran it was a colonel in the KGB, and it was well known who he was.